The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
And from the UK tonight, another reminder that when the left wing is in charge, you're not safe. Well, unless you're a member of the protected class du jour. 18-year-old student Henry Nowak was walking home when he was brutally stabbed 5 times with what's being called a ceremonial knife by 23-year-old Vikram Digwa. As Nowak lay there slowly dying, Digwa lied to police, saying that he was racially abused by the teen.
Has anyone been hurt other than him?
Yeah,
his,
me.
His grandma, brother, took my turban off, started grabbing my head.
Are you injured?
Yeah, I've got swollen eye, a little bruise.
All right, just step back a little bit for me. Someone flag these down.
Nowak begged for help. Before we show you this clip, I want to warn you, the body cam footage you're about to see is highly disturbing.
Just think of it. An 18-year-old lad, a student, been out with some friends for the evening, on the way home, and victim of a sustained attack. Stabbed several times, chased down the street. Stabbed seriously 5 times. And what happens? Well, the assailant's brother rings the police to say, we've just been racially attacked and abused by a white guy. The sirens blare, they arrive. Young Henry must have thought that at last help was at hand, but far, far from it. The police act from the beginning to the end, and the end when he dies, lying on a pavement, having been stabbed, in handcuffs. The last thing he heard on this earth was him being read his rights by the police. He was actually treated in a way that meant an accusation of a racial slur was treated more seriously than an act of murder.
This is the reverse of George Floyd. Mr. Nowak was not on drugs. He was not resisting arrest. He was not committing a felony, cashing a check. He did not have a criminal record. He had not had a home invasion. People did not riot for 4 months, destroy, $2 billion of property, kill 35 people. None of that. It was just DEI, the DEI knife. It's against the law in the UK to carry a knife larger than 5 inches, except if it's a ceremonial DEI sword, sort of speak.
And Victor, when you see what's happening across Europe now, the influx of migrants, mass immigration, refugees, the coddling of criminals, the targeting in many ways, at least they feel that way, of native-born Brits, the old British system in decline. I think it's in despair. And can it be saved at this point?
The sick man of Europe. I think Ron Fraser, the late Ron Fraser, had an article that went by that title back in 2008. Herbert Armstrong was talking about it in the 1960s. It was seen as that because of its declining economy and losing the power of the pound. But it's sick in more ways than that. As you can see from this unbelievable story, the reverse of George Floyd, a racial slur, if he even said it, that's treated more seriously than being stabbed, I guess, 5 times. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at the website, thetrumpet.com, or the Rumble channel or YouTube channel. Send us some email, td@thetrumpet.com. Lots to get to on today's show, including what I hope will be a segment at the end. I probably won't get through the full study that I have, but maybe it can carry over into tomorrow. But it's a study about studying. It's a study about Herbert Armstrong and the diligence that he put into his calling from the beginning, 100 years ago, going back to 1926. And his lifelong study of God's word in particular, I mean, it continued. It continued for 60 years until he died in 1986. And here we are. We just passed the 40-year anniversary of his death. We just visited Eugene, Oregon, the birthplace of the Philadelphia era of God's church. We played that segment for you the other day. That'll be on the Key of David this weekend, by the way. So you can be praying about the response to that. And you can be praying about the theme that we hope to keep coming back to in the coming months. Really trying to emulate the example of the end-time Elijah, studying like him, having a prayer life as effective as he did, showing some ambition, some drive, having your heart in the work, fighting against adversaries, resisting against the devil. He wasn't perfect, but he had on the whole armor of God and went to war for God every day. And so must we. Heart-wrenching story coming out of the UK. It's been unfolding now. I guess it happened back in December. And more has come out. I like, by the way, how they blurred the faces of the officers. I think it was all of 2 seconds before we had every picture of the officer involved in George Floyd back in 2020. And then, even though we see the pictures, you know how many times the regime media desperately wants for you to believe that, well, they're all Caucasian for sure. If there's any bit of color, it doesn't count in the case of an attacking officer. In their minds, they're white. The white people are the racists. Here you have, as VDH said in that cold open, the reverse George Floyd. He's not on drugs. He's coming back from being out with his football playing buddies. He's 18. The Sikh who says he needs to carry a sword, basically, because of his religion, of course, for everyone else. You know, for the white people, well, that's illegal. If it was reversed and the white kid who bled to death in front of the perpetrator and his family and the officers, what's incredible is he told the officer, one of them, "I've been stabbed." And the officer said, "I don't think you have been, mate." So you hear the Sikh say, yeah, it was a racial slur. They believe it. They swallow it. The DEI manual says you have to. And meanwhile, this young kid stabbed 5 times. Is this going to lead to the whole world going up in flames for 4 months? I don't think so. They'll try to blow up the demonstrations in the UK, people outraged, and for good reason. They'll try to make those sound like, oh, they're very violent. You compare them, and maybe we'll do that on this show, to what happened after George Floyd, and then the talking heads making excuses for it. Oh, they have to burn buildings. The statement has to be made. And people the world over, half of the UK was bowing down on one knee at the altar of George Floyd, the drug-addicted, lifelong criminal with a rap sheet that just kept going on and on and on. All the details. They show you the picture of the officers. Got to do that because they're racist. And then what do they conceal? Oh, he's high on fentanyl. We find that out many weeks later. The BBC says, first-year university student Henry Nowak, 18, had been stabbed multiple times with an 8-inch ceremonial knife when officers in Southampton arrived at the scene in December. He was walking back to his student accommodation. He was a college student. Alone after a night out with his football teammates when he encountered the killer, Vikran Digwa, Digwa, who had used a blade, he said he carried because of his Sikh faith. He's just doing it because of his faith. Because he's religious, don't you know? Never mind the UK law. An 8-inch knife. He tried to claim that he acted in self-defense and that Henry was drunk, shouted racist abuse, hit him, and knocked off his turban. But it was found Henry had alcohol levels below the drink drive limit when he died. So the Sikh, the religious man, lied about the drunkenness. It says here, the prosecution said Digwa had invented a wicked lie to try to save himself from jail, and the jury agreed. You know, I didn't do enough reading on this case, though. But if the brother's there backing up the lies, and the mother as well, and then the police officers, the kid is bleeding out in front of everyone. Nah, I don't think you got stabbed, mate. And he dies right in front of the whole group. And who else is going to be held to account? The mother? The family of the Sikh? Is it just going to be the stabber and that's it? What about the police officers? Why are their faces blurred out? December. So this is 6 months later. What an outrage. You know, as I was telling the news gatherers this morning, the fact that the perpetrator would stab a young British lad to death and then not flee the scene. Now, the family did try to hide the knife, but they all stayed right there and said, yeah, we're the victims. And the police believed it. Don't think you got stabbed, mate. It says, but when police arrived, it was Henry, a University of Southampton finance student, who was handcuffed and arrested after Digwa made his bogus accusations. He was handcuffed, he was arrested, and he bled to death. Now, what if the roles were reversed here? What if Henry was the Sikh who got stabbed to death by the white football player? God says in Isaiah 5, verses 20 to 23, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil. He was a man of faith, the killer. He stabbed him not once, not twice, 5 times. And the young kid bled to death as he was trying to flee from the murderer, the terrorist. It says, woe unto them that are mighty to drink wine, and men of strength to mingle strong drink, which justify the wicked for reward and deprive the innocent of his right. Here the family's lying about the kid being drunk. And here you can see them just drunk on power. They've got the upper hand. They know this. That's why they didn't flee the scene. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 44 says that the head's going to become the tail, and the tail is going to become the head. So here you have, and Britain, for its part, just invites in the different religions, cultures, you know, the faiths where they have to carry swords around. Everyone else, you know, you're going to be arrested for carrying a butter knife. But the Sikh, I mean, that's different. He's a man of God. They invite the whole world in, and they conform to the third world standards. And lo and behold, Britain turns into virtually a third world country. That's the truth. That's what's happening. The decline in Britain, there it's both Britain and the United States are prophesied to collapse. But Britain is just about a generation out front of the United States collapse. So we're getting a preview And so is little Judah in the Middle East. The tail has become the head. They know they have the upper hand, these Gentile peoples, these pagan religions. They know they have the upper hand. That's why they don't flee the scene. Anyone else, I mean, just committing a murder, they're probably going to run. Not this time. No, instead, they're there. The police arrive, and they tell the police that the kid who's bleeding out on the ground is the evil one. He's the threat to society. He's the problem. The Telegraph says here, Hampshire and Isle of Wight constabulary is facing claims that an overemphasis on DEI meant the officers had been trained to respond the way they did. The force said in 2022 that being anti-racist, ethical, and inclusive is the top of our agenda. This is your police force in the UK. We are here to be anti-racist and ethical. So when we hear from the minority at the scene that the white kid barely, he's not even out of his teens. When we hear from the minorities that the white kid, that he said something that was a racial slur, that's what we're trying to blot out. Racism, racial slurs. The knives, not so much. We'll let the Sikh carry the knife. Hampshire police gives mandatory DEI training to all officers as part of its race action plan, which promises to understand the impact, trauma, and history of police ethnic minority communities. It says serving officers have told the Telegraph that junior officers are so fearful of being accused of racism that they default to the safest option when called to incidents that involve anyone from an ethnic minority. Shall I read it again? The default position is believe the ethnic minority and don't believe the white kid. I've been stabbed. No, you haven't, mate. The police officer actually said to the dying boy, you were not stabbed. And he was stabbed 5 times. But don't worry, if you're that police officer, we've got the face blurred out. Nobody needs to know. Just get back into your DEI manual and make sure that you are on board with the crusade to end racism. I should actually say the crusade to end racism against minorities. If it's against the majority, it's not a problem. This is Britain today. And the U.S., as I say, is not very far behind. You saw it with George Floyd. The whole world went up in flames. You couldn't watch a soccer game in Britain without all the teams taking a knee to honor George Floyd. Is anybody going to be honoring Henry? There's a few protesters here and there now. How long is that going to go on? Are they going to burn down London? Upside down world. Being anti-racist, ethical, and inclusive is our top agenda. Well, it's the same quote I gave you. The death of stabbing victim Henry Nowak was a near inverted image of the Floyd case, a white man dying on the ground because Hampshire police officers ignored his pleas for help. If you can believe it, poor Henry was actually saying what George Floyd said, I can't breathe. And that became a slogan. That became a chant for the looters, for the vandals, for the criminals that destroyed cities. I can't breathe. Well, here's a case where he wasn't drugged up on fentanyl, but he couldn't breathe. The officers had him on his side. They handcuffed him, hands behind his back. He says, I've been stabbed. I've been stabbed. No, you haven't, mate. One senior police officer told the Telegraph for years, officers have been subjected to cultural awareness and DEI training that, in many cases, presents policing as institutionally racist by default. So they're terrified. They certainly don't want to be criticized of being a racist themselves. So let's just say Henry's the racist. Says later, that's why the Henry Nowak incident does not shock me. I can easily imagine inexperienced officers attending the scene, fearful of making the wrong decision and conscious of the professional consequences of being accused of racism or misconduct. You see, these ethnic minorities, they know. They've caught on. They know that just to make the accusation, that's going to have white people quaking in fear. That's the truth of it. It says here, Rick Pryor was the chairman of the Metropolitan Police Federation. He said Mr. Nowak's death reflected the same issues he was sacked for talking about, that officers were being unduly affected by the worry or threat of being accused of and investigated for racism. He's not surprised, but, you know, he got sacked because he talked about it. You don't talk about it. Don't talk about DEI. Just go to the scene. And if an ethnic minority says there was a racial slur, that's the truth. Bottom line. Believe it. Believe it even when a victim, a helpless victim, is bleeding out on the ground. All of those witnesses. And not one of them, the family, they sided with the murderer, their murdering son. The police, not one person. You saw the video. I mean, how many were there? Counting the family, what, 8, 9 people? And not one person helped the victim. Says here, it also contained a warning to officers. This is the DEI manual, you know, which is really concerned about what's ethical. Our internal reporting mechanisms are strong. We have a proven track record of removing those found guilty of racism. This is the DEI manual. No matter what rank they hold, I mean, we will remove that officer instantly. And they've done it. And so the other officers, as you heard in some of those articles, they show up at a scene and they are terrified of the racism accusation. Play this clip from, you heard Farage, Nigel Farage, a bit in the cold open. This is clip 10.
Now, what has happened over the last few decades is without anybody being asked, without anybody ever voting for it, we've been subjected to mass immigration on a scale that is truly unbelievable. At least 10 million new people have come to Britain in the last 20 years, but far too many that have come have refused to integrate, are leading parallel lives, and leaving many of our cities almost culturally unrecognisable from what they've always been. But to stop any criticism of this, we brought in hate speech laws. We brought in a DEI agenda. We brought in what is called positive discrimination in favour of ethnic minorities over those of white people whose families have lived in Britain in many cases for centuries. That is the mess that we've got into. And that is why, in some ways, what happened, and despite the appalling behaviour of those police officers, but in some ways, what happened on that night in Southampton perhaps shouldn't be a surprise in two-tier Britain.
Two-tiered Britain. We've heard about that here in the United States. Two standards. One for this group over here and another for this group. Appalling behavior, as he says there. And yet, it's not surprising, is it? So, I mean, we made this point back in the George Floyd Summer of Love. What's the next incident going to be that sets off a violent rampage? In this case, I mean, you've got a few protesting. All of this DEI nonsense. I mean, it's die by suicide, as Lincoln said. It'll die down, though. and people will keep their mouths shut. The whole point of it, as he said there, the whole point of these hate speech laws and so on is never mind that 10 million foreigners have come to Britain over the last two decades. You just keep your mouth shut. If you don't like it, you better not say it. And so Britain being overrun with foreigners, something, by the way, that is unique to Israelite nations. What other nation does it? I mean, I guess you could say, you could argue there's a few nations in Europe, the heart of Europe, that are doing it too. But what other nations would just open the door? You're a Sikh? Well, and you need an 8-inch knife? Okay, great, fine. One standard for that group and another standard for your own people. Play clip 11.
Let's have a look at the reaction to what happened to George Floyd, a drug-addled career criminal. Loads of MPs took the knee, including Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner. Sadiq Khan released a little video about it.
The brutal killing of George Floyd has rightly ignited fury, not just in America, but around the world. I completely understand the depth of anger it's caused. I feel it too.
Well, I haven't seen him say a word about Henry Novak. Yeah, we saw actual riots after George Floyd's death, didn't we? Here it is. Yeah, that's in Britain. I mean, did anyone on the left really say that these people should just calm down a bit, moderate their language, wouldn't want to inflame tensions? What else happened after George Floyd? They created the Police Race Action Plan, which committed every single chief constable in England and Wales to building an explicitly, quote, anti-racist police service. Yeah, can we get a nationwide plan now to make sure that police actually believe white teenagers when they say that they've been stabbed by an ethnic minority?
Pretty amazing, the reaction. Comparing the reaction in Britain. George Floyd was an American. But in Britain, on the radical left, I mean, they reacted with some force, with some strength, changing laws even, changing the way their police officers operated. And it wasn't just here in the United States. What a year, 2020, together with COVID. The devil was active in that year, and he still is. He's bringing our nations to our knees. And Britain just got a head start, going back a couple generations. America's following hot on its heels. This is from the Telegraph, too. A red fox, an Atlantic puffin, or the common frog are among the animals that could replace Winston Churchill on the five-pound note. So they're going to replace Churchill on the five-pound note, or $5 if you were here in the States, with an animal, I guess. That's announced by the Bank of England. The Bank of England. We're replacing Churchill. Little bit of the dear leader in the Bank of England. Evidently, get rid of the Churchill bust. Now get rid of the Churchill five-pound bill, five-pound note. I mean, you read some of this and you're like, is this for real? Is this a joke? You're going to replace Churchill with a frog? The Bank of England on Wednesday published a short list of 18 native animals that could appear on its next series of banknotes, including mammals, birds, amphibians, insects, and fish. Writing in the Telegraph, Andrew Bailey said that Britain's wildlife and nature were an important part of our national heritage. They love their national heritage, except when it comes to white people and traditional Christianity, that sort of thing. They despise that. But in this case, hey, the animals, the animals need our support. It says, he said, The move to put animals on banknotes came after feedback from the public who wanted our banknotes to feature the natural beauty of this country, particularly our wildlife, as it is such an important part of our national heritage. That's right. Not Churchill, not so much. But the frog evidently is very important. The national heritage of Great Britain. You look at this past year or two, the Epstein scandal breaking down Prince Andrew, the royal family in many ways. We went through those stories some time ago about the abortion statistics in Britain, an all-time high. Young gals that just don't want to have a child because their lives have been so miserable. They want to have sex, promiscuous sex, but they don't want the child to live, so they abort the baby so it doesn't have to live a miserable existence. King Charles, how about that one? Praying with the new pope. Bowing before the new pope. And then the weakness with respect to the Middle East or the Iran war. Britain losing its prestige, military bases all over the world. More scandals for those rape gangs. That story hasn't gone away. No matter how hard the major media cover it up. Because, well, you can't sound racist. And those are ethnic minorities carrying out those crimes. So just don't report it. Don't talk about it. And now you have the Henry Nowak cover-up. As I say, Britain is further along in its societal decline. It's got a generation head start on the United States. Herbert Armstrong was spot on when he talked about the cultural shift from the old morality to the new. And then you add in all the other elements of sickness and disease and self-hatred and communist infiltration, radical leftism, but just the rampant sin. Cause and effect. My father, he spoke about the new throne of David back in 2017, saying how that God moved a new throne into his church. And that because of that, we're going to see the royal family in Britain just absolutely implode. And that's what's happened. The signs are all around. I mean, just like Mr. Livingston and I talk about routinely. I mean, just seeing the curses identifies who we are in prophecy. Just read Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. I mean, the first part of it says if you obey, then you're going to stay as the head, and then you'll have the tail underneath. If you disobey, if you commit sins, if you're rebellious, then it's going to flop in the other direction, and the tail will become the head. And the tail will, I guess, murder someone and then hang around to lie to the police because they know the police will believe it. Britain is sick. Britain is really sick. The sick man of Europe, and it goes far beyond finance or the economy. The sickness is there, like Isaiah 1 says, from head all the way down to the toes. We'll finish today's show with some really uplifting and positive content about Herbert W. Armstrong's diligence when it came to study, particularly Bible study. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Celtic Throne is back on tour. This summer, 15 cities, 8 states, 1 unforgettable experience. Experience this revolutionary new show. An electrifying fusion of Irish dance, music, theatre and cinema. Experience the show audiences worldwide are raving about.
Absolutely fantastic. I'm telling you that anybody that comes to see the show is going to be mesmerised.
I've seen the River Dance and the Lord of the Dance, and they were amazing. But this blew me away. It was absolutely amazing. I'd watch it again now.
Absolutely marvellous. And I've been to see Riverdance about 5 times, and this is amazing. Absolutely amazing. I love it.
It's thrilling, I think, is the best way to describe it. It stands at the side of Lord of the Dance and Riverdance. It's equal partner.
Absolutely stunning. Absolutely incredible. Not in my wildest dream did I think that it could compare to the other shows, but it was amazing, amazing.
My favourite show I've been to ever, and I've been to Riverdance, Lord of the Dance, just my favourite. It was amazing.
It was amazing. Best experience ever.
Don't miss your opportunity to experience the trailblazing new Irish dance show capturing the hearts of audiences all over the world. Get show and ticket information at CelticThrone.com.
And if we're not close enough to God in prayer, and remember that when you pray, you talk to Him, but when you read and study your Bible, He's talking to you. Now then, if you just read over the Bible and don't understand it, that's like you open your ear to listen to someone talk, but he's talking in a language you don't understand, or you don't hear him very well, and you don't know a thing he said. What good did it do? Is God really talking to you? Unless you learn how to study what he says and to understand it. But I tell you, the Bible is so deep, and there is so much to it, that no matter how much you've studied and how much you understand it, there is so much in it for you yet to learn. You have no conception. Not one of you has ever studied the Bible enough. You can stop.
It's unlimited. The depth of understanding. Oh, the riches and the depths of God's truth, Paul said in Romans 11. You still have a lot to learn. Notice he emphasized that you have to learn how to study. You have to work on your relationship with God. And he did that. He set an example. I was saying the other day how challenging it is as a minister just to get prospective members to just dig into study, studying God's Word, reading a reprint article, or working their way through Mystery of the Ages, or how about the 36-lesson Bible correspondence course? How many people are willing to put in the time and the effort to work their way through that course? You see what they're consuming, as I said the other day. Tablet, by the way, we quote it often because Lee Smith writes there. That perverted HBO show, Euphoria. What's the title? The God of Euphoria. The God of Euphoria? They're treating this horrible show like it's classical literature. Like it's groundbreaking cinema. Like it's award-worthy content. And all it does is celebrate filth. And they're congratulating the director, the creator of this show, because, well, it's like his bizarre, perverted life. So it's kind of loosely based on the truth. And he, you have to understand, is just a good storyteller. And this is a classic. The God of Euphoria. It's a challenge, isn't it? To get people into the truth of God. To get people to dig into the Bible. To get people to have a prayer life that's effectual and fervent. I mean, that really does produce results. That's a challenge. We're at the 100-year anniversary of Herbert Armstrong's conversion to the truth. When he was confronted, he was challenged from two directions. His wife challenged him on the question of the seventh-day Sabbath. And those of you that know the history know how he responded initially. He thought his wife was a religious fanatic, and he admitted he didn't know the Bible, but he said, surely all these churches can't be wrong. And in Loma, his wife said, well, how do you know that? What if they are wrong? So there was that challenge, and then his sister-in-law challenged him on the subject of evolution, basically said he was ignorant and uneducated because he didn't accept it. So in one challenge, his marriage was on the line. So Mr. Armstrong set out to prove the truth. He proved that the Bible did in fact command the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath. And furthermore, he proved that God does exist. That evolution, the theory of evolution is exactly that. It's just a theory. It's just made up. A man-made bit of human reasoning. Notice 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 17. He set out on a six-month night and day study. He learned how to study. In fact, he had been studying a lot, even up to that point in 1926, except it just wasn't the Bible. But he had learned how to be diligent in studying what he needed to build a career. But during this six-month night and day study, he learned about the truth of God. God was opening his mind, obviously, John 6 and verse 44. But he was digging into this dual challenge. He had to prove the truth. 1 Thessalonians 5:17, it says in the Amplified, "Be unceasingly in prayer, praying perseveringly." Don't give up on prayer. Don't stop praying to God. Pray without ceasing, as it says in the King James. And then verse 18 says, "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Quench not the Spirit," Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1, that we've got to stir up the Spirit of God. I mean, a Christian is one in whom, in the mind of an individual that has the Spirit of God. I kind of butchered that, but it's in Romans 8. That's what defines a true Christian. They're being led by the Spirit. The Spirit has joined together with their human spirit. And that's what makes them the children of God. That's something you have to keep stirring up, otherwise you'll quench it. How do you stir it up? Well, this passage tells us how. Pray without ceasing. Verse 20 says, "Despise not prophesyings, inspired preaching." Make sure that you're going to a preacher so that you can understand, so that you can be taught, so that you can be taught how to study the right way. That's brought out in 2 Timothy 2, verse 15. There is a right and there's a wrong way to do it. Verse 21, the memory verse, it says, "Prove all things, hold fast that which is good." So prove everything. Mr. Armstrong went into that 1926 study 100 years ago. This year's the anniversary. This is the anniversary America and Britain should be focused on. Prove everything and then hold on. Hold fast to what's good, to what's righteous, to what's true. Don't let go of it. You don't want to forget the second half of that verse. It's easy to just prove, well, I shouldn't say it's easy, but you can just prove it and not do anything with it and you'll forget it. It's amazing, even when you look at Ezekiel 33, you read through that passage and God's telling his prophet, "Now you get out there and warn them from me, and if they don't turn, then it's on them." And God was talking about the death of nations in that passage. It's prophecy for today. And you get to the end of that chapter, as many of you know, and it says that, you know, they receive the message, but their heart goes after their coveting. Their heart doesn't match up with, you know, with what they say. And then there's that incredible verse at the very end where it says that they treat the warning message, "Your nation's dying." That's the message. Your nation's dying. They see it as a lovely song, the Bible says. It's pleasant. They like the inspired preaching. They like the melody of Isaiah 58:1 message, essentially. Cry aloud, spare not, tell my people about their sins. I mean, you would think they wouldn't react to it that way even, just even hearing it. But no, there's plenty of people that actually like the strong, you know, message, warning message from a prophet of God. But their heart goes after their coveting. They still won't. It makes me think of Herbert Armstrong. We were just in Eugene, so all of those people that he encountered, not all of them, but a lot of the Sardis people, I mean, they were pushing him forward. Like, I want you to, you know, go do this Bible campaign in Harrisburg, Oregon. You're pretty good at preaching. I like your energy. I like the way you expound on the Bible. And then when it came down to it, they rejected Herbert Armstrong. They rejected what he was preaching. Their heart went after their coveting. Coming back to the example that he set, that dual challenge, I mean, in the midst of that challenge, Mr. Armstrong learned how to have a Bible-backed reason for everything he did. He learned that the Bible is God's instruction manual. He learned that the Bible is Jesus Christ in print. He developed a relationship with God through Bible study and also prayer, as he brought out in that clip. This is from the autobiography. He says about this experience, I had studied diligently after leaving high school at age 18 and continuously up to this incident in 1926. So in 26, he would have been 34. So from 18 to 34, he said, I studied diligently. How many 18 to 34-year-olds would fall into that category? Just even leaving religion aside. Studying diligently. Our minds are so numb, and we've immersed ourselves into the world of escapism to where we're flocking to movies or programs about some disturbed young man creating a show about his bizarre life, his drug-addicted life, his promiscuous life, his anti-family life. When you're filling up on that, well, you know the saying, garbage in, garbage out. I had studied diligently after leaving high school at age 18 and continuously up to this incident in 1926, but I was now entering on a field of research in which previous study had been minimal. I didn't have much experience with studying the Bible. That's what he's saying. I began this intensified study by obtaining everything I could find in the way of books, pamphlets, and other literature, both for and against what was often called the Jewish Sabbath. I wanted not only everything I could lay hands on the case for Sunday and against the Seventh-day Sabbath, I wanted also the arguments or proponents for it, which I hoped to be able honestly to refute. He went into the Sabbath challenge wanting to refute his wife, wanting to prove his wife wrong. He went in, though, willing to look at both sides and to prove what was the truth. Notice what it says in 2 Timothy 2, starting in verse 14. It says, of these things, put them in remembrance. Paul's telling Timothy, look, help the brethren. Give them focus in their study. Don't let them get caught up into vain ramblings that are worthless, that are time-wasting. Keep them focused, charging them, it says, before the Lord, that they strive not about words to no profit, but to the subverting of the hearers, And then verse 15, the memory verse says, study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. You've got to be a good workman. You've got to be willing to study. And that dual challenge shows that he was. Listen to this from another message he gave back in the 1960s or 70s. Clip two.
Now, it just happened that both evolution and this Sabbath question my wife had taken up with had a common starting point, the book of Genesis in the Bible. But I didn't begin with the book of Genesis. I began my study by getting the works of Darwin and the account of his trip around the world and the good ship Beagle and all of that. And then I got the writings of Haeckel and Huxley and modern one, Chamberlain, who was the professor emeritus in the University of Chicago, and others. I delved into what Lamarck had to say about use and disuse, which was a discarded theory and had come up before Darwin's time, and Lyell and all of the old evolutionists. And I began some of the study in the Bible. To make a long story short, I proved before that 6 months was over that God does exist. That God is the first cause and the creator of matter and of all of us, even of spirit bodies, spirit beings called angels, of everything that is. I came to learn who and what God is, and not one religion in the world believes that or understands it. You know, that just makes me stand aghast when I think of that.
He wanted to prove everything. He wanted to prove all things. Now, the Bible also says about this man right here that he restored all things to the church. And soon God's going to restore all things to the world. Acts 3, 19 through 21. But you can read about the restoration of all things to the church in Matthew 17, Malachi 4. So looking to this man's example, I mean, you can see why we need to. He's, of course, leading us to God. I mean, I don't want to take God out of the equation. In fact, John 6:44 shows that God's the one that triggered this dual challenge, a night and day study. But would God have been able to work with someone who wasn't diligent or willing to prove everything, to prove all things? You can see why we need to be ambitious when it comes to our relationship with God. We need to be like the Bereans who searched, diligently searched the scriptures daily to see if what Paul was saying was true. Digging into the Word of God, restoring all things to the church, and really having an unselfish, outflowing concern for the good and welfare of others. That man that you just saw on the screen, that was the greatest educator of the 20th century. And he really and truly wanted to help others understand the truth of the Bible. He expounded upon the Bible. He started in with a diligence in study. He started to write out all of his personal studies into an article format, not even knowing at the time that those articles would later be printed. The first manuscript for the United States and Britain in Prophecy, that was produced back in the late 1920s. 300 pages. He was digging. And he continued to dig throughout his entire ministry. And we will too, in the coming weeks and months ahead, digging into this vital history of God's work in the last days. That's all we have time for on today's show, the fastest moving hour in broadcasting. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.